Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier, longer, and happier. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician and scientist specializing in lifestyle-based disease prevention and management and applied well-being. In this episode, we'll be discussing the importance of cardiorespiratory fitness, often measured by a VO2 max test, which has emerged as a single most critical vital sign for health and longevity. My guest is Brady Holmer, who's a researcher and science writer. He has a master's degree in human performance from the University of Florida. He frequently writes about exercise and nutrition in his popular newsletter, Physiologically Speaking, a publication dedicated to providing the latest science-based information on health and human performance. Brady, thank you so much for joining.
Sharon, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Brady, we hear a lot about different dimensions of exercise. There's obviously a lot of interest in avoiding sedentary time and moving and getting in steps. Of course, there's a lot of emphasis on physical activity guidelines. And the focus of our conversation is cardiorespiratory fitness. Can you kind of paint the landscape of the importance of each of these pieces of advice?
Yeah, for sure. So if we are just talking about cardiorespiratory fitness, I know we're going to be bringing that up so much today, so maybe we can define it really quickly, but it goes by many names. So cardiorespiratory fitness, aerobic fitness, or VO2 max, they sort of all mean the same thing, but sort of different. So VO2 max would technically refer to if you go into a laboratory and got your fitness measured using one of those very devious treadmill tests that are no fun to do, that would be your VO2 max, and it's your maximal rate of oxygen consumption during exercise. Cardiorespiratory fitness is related to your VO2 max, but it could also be assessed using like a 12-minute run test or some other type of like fitness test. So while the two are kind of interchangeable, and we will probably use them interchangeable today, I think it's important maybe for people to know that they are slightly different. Some studies look at cardiorespiratory fitness, some will look at VO2 max, but that's emerging as a very important predictor of your risk for cardiovascular disease, brain health, all-cause mortality, all of these studies coming out. Granted, they're observational studies, so showing us an association, not necessarily causation, but providing a pretty strong link between your fitness and your risk of death and disease. So VO2 max is certainly an important component to health. But as you mentioned, there are lots of, I think, components that we need to think about when we think about our health. And unfortunately, in kind of this world of like social media and podcasting, we hear something like VO2 max and we just get very attracted to it. And people like to say, well, we're just going to focus on VO2 max as our biomarker. But of course, there are lots of other things to focus on, like you said, such as sedentary time. So I think that's one component of health that we really need to be focusing on, limiting being sedentary as much as we can. So limiting our time doing what we're doing right now, sitting in a chair. Not that this is bad. We're obviously having a stimulating conversation and we'll hopefully get up and go for a walk after this, but limiting sedentary time. And then overall, outside of working to improve our fitness through actual exercise, which we could define as structured physical activity, just being physically active. So moving as much as possible. I think there are really strong associations between that and health as well. So even independent of whether you're meeting the physical activity guidelines each week, just making sure you are moving frequently, breaking up your sedentary time, all of these things have important kind of ramifications for our physical health.
And to your point about singular focus on any one of these, the desired outcome, like can you reach a good level of health if you, for example, focus on cardiorespiratory fitness but are sedentary?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that it would be hard to achieve a sufficient level of cardiorespiratory fitness if you're a sedentary, but I guess in theory, you know, if we have like a thought experiment where someone is sedentary for 11 hours of the day, but they work out hard for 1 hour a day, you could sort of just say, I'm trying to optimize for my VO2 max. I'm just going to do a high intensity interval workout for 30 minutes every day. The rest of my day, I'm sitting and watching Netflix. I don't think that's ideal for health, but you probably could certainly get your VO2 max high doing that. That's not something that I would suggest, but I think you could probably do that independently. I think that would kind of be a misguided strategy though, and sort of missing the maybe the forest for the trees in that situation. So it could happen, but like I think we should take a more holistic approach towards it. And yes, you want to do things that will improve your view to max, but also not compromise other areas in your life.
And I bring it up because the reality is a lot of people have very sedentary jobs, but do their best to carve out time for exercise. In that scenario, can a person make up for the sedentary time, if you will, through that exercise? Or are these both just so equally weighted in importance that the focus should be kind of balanced between both of those goals?
I think to some extent, yes. So if you work a sedentary job, a desk job, then exercising for, you know, 30, 60, maybe even 90 minutes a day should definitely be a priority to sort of offset that sedentary behavior that you're doing. But interestingly, there have been some very interesting like studies in the past few years to come out showing that even if you do meet the physical activity guidelines, so say you're exercising 150 to 300 minutes per week, you're getting your moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise every week, even if you're sedentary outside of that, that seems to be associated with worse health compared to somebody doing the same amount of exercise who is a little bit more active throughout the day and not totally sedentary. And in fact, being sedentary outside of your physical activity actually seems to impair some of the benefits and the adaptations that you get from physical activity. So to use just one example, when we exercise, that seems to improve our ability to utilize fat, so be better fat burners, you could say. And so, you know, if you exercise and then you eat a meal, your body's going to be better able to utilize that fuel. You'll kind of have less of an increase in glucose and fatty acids after that meal because your body's using it. Well, if you're sedentary throughout the week and you also engage in that exercise, you're not as good at sort of handling that meal. So your body's just not as metabolically efficient and it hasn't gained the same benefits of exercise when you're sedentary. So I think we need to consider the spectrum of what we're doing outside of our activity because it actually seems to have some important implications for health. And we can actually put some kind of numbers to it. They actually did a study where they reduced people's step counts during like an exercise training. And so if you took less than, I think it was less than 5,000 steps per day and you were exercise training, you didn't get as many benefits as a group of people who were doing 7,500 to 8,000 steps per day. So something that I actually like to recommend and even implement for myself is no matter how much exercise you're doing every day, make sure to get 7,500 steps just outside of your exercise and then kind of moderate that or modulate that based on your activity level. So if you're less active on a particular day, maybe you want to get 10, 12,000 steps per day. I think that kind of be a good framework for people to think about it, but we should certainly think about the two as being not independent, so dependent on one another rather than independent.
Mm-hmm. And cardiorespiratory fitness, what does it represent? Like what determines it?
Yeah, so cardiorespiratory fitness, it represents, and this is why I think it's such a good measure of longevity and health span, because it represents our body's integrative ability to take in air from the environment, distribute that oxygen into our blood, and then distribute that blood to organs and tissues in our body. And then for those organs, tissues, mitochondria, to utilize the oxygen that it extracts from that blood to produce energy. So it's not just something very simple like, say, LDL cholesterol or maybe even grip strength, which I think is a very kind of local measure of strength that has still been associated with lifespan and health span. You can't fake a good VO2 max. If your body is not fit and all your systems are not working correctly together, your cardiovascular system and your metabolic systems are not functioning properly, you are not going to have a high VO2 max because you need to be metabolically efficient in order to have a high VO2 max. And so for that reason, I think, again, why it's so strongly kind of associated with health outcomes. And regarding the components of VO2 max, so I kind of just mentioned it's our cardiovascular system. So it involves the lungs, lung size, our ability to take in oxygen. It involves our heart, kind of one of the main components. The most important determinant of VO2 max is going to be your stroke volume. For people who may not be familiar with that, that's essentially the amount of blood that your heart can pump out in a single beat. And so the larger stroke volume in response to exercise training, that is a large determinant of the improvement in VO2 max. So that's one of the huge components of VO2 max. And then again, also, you know, our body's ability to deliver blood to skeletal muscle, and then our what is called diffusing capacity, which essentially is the ability of oxygen to diffuse from the blood into the muscle, into the mitochondria, and then the mitochondria's ability to use that for energy. So there are lots of components to VO2 max. You know, when we train, we can't really train any of those singular components. You can kind of do different types of training to do that. Certain types of training might be better for improving your heart function or your lung function or your mitochondrial function. But really, when we train, we're charting all of those systems.
Yeah. And the fact that cardiorespiratory fitness represents so many of our body systems, as you mentioned, cardiovascular system, lung system, skeletal muscle system, mitochondria, and metabolic health, it carries so much weight in as a predictor, really, of our health. You mentioned its role in brain health, cardiovascular disease, longevity. Can you give some numbers around how important and why it's important, why it should be, you know, I know the American Heart Association has called on it to be called a vital sign. Can you speak more around the numbers and what it represents?
Yeah, sure. So depending on the study that you look at, X improvement will lead to whatever reduction. So the number that I commonly cite, there was a study looking at VO2 max and all-cause mortality, and that suggested that improving your VO2 max by just one metabolic equivalent. So VO2 max is measured in milliliters of oxygen per kilogram of body weight per minute. So just improving your VO2 max by one of those, so improving it by 3 mLs per kg per minute, was associated with, I believe, a 19% reduction in all-cause mortality. So that is one way to think about it, just in terms of this improvement kind of leads to a drastic reduction in risk of dying from any cause, which is important. So, because that includes cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, et cetera. Regarding what the number should be, I can't really give great recommendations on that because it will depend on your age and your sex. I think what would be good for people to think about is, you know, you could find a chart on the American College of Sports Medicine or a VO2 max chart. Even if you just type it into Google, you'll be able to find a VO2 max chart with kind of age and sex-based references towards your VO2 max. Shoot to be above average. I think we all shoot to be above average in everything in life. And in reality, there will be a lot of people who are average because that is what the average is. But take a look at those values and then try to get above the average for your age and sex. I think that would be a good goal for most people, because what most of the studies show up to a certain point, some even showing no kind of plateau, but VO2 max and the reduction in disease risk or the improvement in brain health, for example, it seems to be dose dependent. So if you improve your VO2 max more, you get more of a reduction. And some studies would suggest that there's no upper limit. I have said that before, and I tend to think that there probably is an upper limit, but most studies don't look at elite athletes. You know, they're looking at people with a VO2 max maybe between 50 and 60 at the highest, which granted is a very good VO2 max, but it's not 75 or 80 like you might see in an elite marathon runner or a triathlete or something like that. So I think that the benefits probably don't level out, or at least we don't know where they kind of level out. And so trying to get it as high as possible will, I think, afford even greater benefits. But again, regarding the numbers, I think it's hard to sell somebody, oh, shoot for this number, because it depends on a lot of different factors, but just look to improve it. A lot of the things, and maybe we'll talk about this soon, but if you have a wearable device, if you have an Apple Watch, if you have an Oura Ring, a Whoop strap, it'll tell you your VO2 max. And so you can at least use that to see directionally if you're improving, if you're maintaining kind of what your fitness is looking like over time.
Some of those smartwatches, so there's some shortcomings as well. How good do you think measuring through those smartwatches is relative to, as you mentioned in the beginning, there are several ways of testing VO2 max or testing cardiorespiratory fitness, I should say.
They're not the most accurate. And so what I like to recommend to people is that they're going to be, for the most part, directionally correct. So if you increase your VO2 max, or if your watch tells you that your VO2 max increases, it probably increased. And if it tells you it decreased, it probably decreased. If it says you're staying the same, it's more than likely that you're staying the same. So even if that exact number isn't correct, and it won't be far off, you know, it's not going to cut your VO2 max in half or double it when it, you know, it's not going to give you a 60 if you're a 30, but it might be 4 to 5 points off, for example. That's kind of some common numbers that I've seen, and even with myself. So they're not the most accurate, but again, I think they'll tell you if you're moving in the right direction or not. And so in that way, they can certainly be useful. I would recommend, you know, there are other things that people can do to estimate their VO2 max, like do a 12-minute run test and plug your time into an online calculator. That's an easy way to do it if you don't want to go into a lab. But then obviously, you know, if you're someone who's very interested in VO2 max, you want to see if it corresponds to what's on your watch, or you're just interested in that data, you know, check out your local university or your local physical therapy clinic or something. A lot of these places are doing metabolic testing now for $100 to $150, which in my opinion, given what we're talking about today and like the prognostic value of VO2 max is a small investment, I think, at least in my eyes.
In terms of prognostic factors, can you anchor it relative to some risk factors that we know for heart disease, for example, such as elevated blood sugar, elevated blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking? How does VO2 max or cardiorespiratory fitness compare as a predictor, something that we should strive for optimizing compared to these other risks?
At least in the studies that have compared sort of the risks and the associations between all of those, it seems to be a stronger predictor than smoking or any of the single cardiometabolic risk factors. So I think that's, again, very important information. And when we think about just one of these risk factors, like obviously body weight is pretty important and cigarette smoking is important, but VO2 max seems to be a little more important than all of those and be more predictive.
Yeah. And I ask that as someone in healthcare, we have so much emphasis on these cardiometabolic risk factors. Don't do a whole lot to promote cardiorespiratory fitness. So I think putting that in the perspective of just how important it is doesn't get said enough. So I think that's really helpful. Let's talk about how to improve cardiorespiratory fitness. So if somebody wants to do a test, let's say a 12-minute run test, and or their smartwatch tells them that they are kind of below average and they want to raise their level, how would you recommend people begin?
It will, you know, obviously depend kind of on your starting point, but the short answer, which then I can expand on, is, you know, aerobic exercise training is obviously the way that you're going to improve that. And, you know, it's funny because there's just so much debate currently about what the best type of training is to improve your VO2 max, because, you know, we'll bring up another buzzword. This zone 2 training has kind of recently gained traction and people are talking all about that. You know, if you hear that term, most of the time people aren't referring to what a physiologist might consider to be zone 2, but rather they're just, it's almost a euphemism for low intensity, low to moderate intensity aerobic exercise, basically. They say get your zone 2 training. That just means do your easy kind of lower heart rate aerobic exercise. That's at least the way that I see it. So people will argue that zone 2 is the best way to improve your VO2 max. In reality, and you know, there's a lot of nuance to the discussion, but in reality, the best way to improve your VO2 max is going to be to engage in high intensity interval training. So exercise at a high percentage of your maximal heart rate or your VO2 max. Interestingly, there was actually a study that came out that was just published this week, and they were showing what predicts a greater improvement in VO2 max in response to training, and spending more time at a heart rate, or I guess at an intensity around 90% or more of your VO2 max, or closer like to your maximal heart rate, was associated with the greatest improvement to VO2 max. Now that might seem obvious because, you know, if you think about training, this principle of specificity, it would state that, you know, whenever you want to improve, you should train. So train at a high percentage of your VO2 max if you want to increase your VO2 max. If you want to elevate your ceiling, your performance ceiling, well, you kind of have to train near that ceiling. If people want improvements, greater improvements in their VO2 max, that's going to be the best way to get there. Now, the nuanced part of that is going to be, well, the studies using high intensity interval training are typically having the participants perform it 2 or 3 times a week. For most people, that's not sustainable. You can do a high intensity interval session 3 times per week for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, or 8 weeks. But, you know, you, Sharon, and your listeners, and even me, we're all interested in kind of what we can do in the long term. What's sustainable? What can we do like throughout our life to improve and maintain our fitness and health? So obviously that doesn't mean doing 3 very, very, very hard interval training sessions every week, because you're going to either burn out or get injured or something like that. So we have to be a little bit more balanced. And even though, yes, even when we compare high intensity to moderate intensity training, high intensity training is better, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also do our zone 2 or lower intensity training. Because the way that I think about it is that lower intensity training will kind of form the foundation. If we're thinking about our fitness like a pyramid, that kind of forms the base or the foundation of a pyramid. Endurance athletes, when they're doing their training over the summer, they always talk about it being base training. You're not really doing anything that hard. You're just going out every day and running, sometimes easy, sometimes a little bit less easy, but it's kind of like foundational or base training. And that's important because it does improve mitochondrial function and it does lend itself to improving aerobic fitness in a way. But then if you really want to kind of sharpen and up your ceiling, up your VO2 max, that's going to take high intensity interval training. And then regarding a specific prescription for that, everybody always wants like, well, what type of intervals and how long? Anything seems to work. You know, you can do intervals that are 60 seconds in length. You can do intervals that are 2 minutes. You can do intervals that are 10 minutes. My recommendation would kind of be, I think intervals in the range of like 2 minutes to 4 minutes tend to be the best because you get a decent amount of time where you're actually exercising at kind of close to your VO2 max or at a high heart rate, but it's not so long that you're really going to then fatigue at the end of that interval. 4 minutes seems to be a good kind of duration, but obviously people can do whatever they want. The important thing is that your heart rate is increased and you're going pretty hard.
And in terms of, you know, for people who don't measure zones or heart rate, but want to be optimizing their cardiorespiratory fitness, what would that look like? So a moderate walk, how would you advise people to know that they are in the ranges where they're benefiting?
For sure. So I'll talk about kind of the lower intensity and then the higher intensity training. So when we talk about lower intensity, if you're not using heart rate, if you can't hold a conversation, kind of like what you and I are doing right now, you can speak in full sentences, then that's probably easy enough to classify that as your easy training. The talk test is kind of a very easy way to do that. If you can speak in almost a full sentence, then you're probably going easy enough. But again, for some people, that might be a brisk walk. For somebody who's more trained, that might be a slow jog. You know, for an elite athlete, that might be, you know, you're running at 7 minute per mile pace and you can still hold the conversation. So it will obviously depend on your fitness level, but that's why I think the talk test is a good kind of parameter because we're not talking about a certain speed or a certain power output on a bike. We're just saying, can you talk? And that's going to kind of dictate that for everyone. Now, if you're doing high intensity interval training, how do you know if you're going hard enough? Well, maybe you can get out one or two words in between breaths, but that's about it. That kind of is going to indicate that you're at an intensity that is sufficiently high. You can also use something called perceived exertion. So that's just a fancy way of saying, how hard do you feel like you're going? A typical scale, and it's a weird scale used in exercise physiology, is called the Borg scale. It goes from 6 to 20. That might seem weird for people, but it's kind of based on the idea that if you add a 0 to whatever your RPE is, that corresponds to your heart rate. And therefore, it's kind of loosely associated with intensity. So if I tell you, oh, I'm at a 20, well, my heart rate might be 200, and that's close to many people's maximal heart rate. And then 60 would be somewhere around resting. But you could also just use a 1 to 10 scale. For a lot of people, that might be easier. You know, you're not in a research study, you're just using it for your own personal use. So just have a scale from 1 to 10. And, you know, if you're doing lower intensity training, you should probably be somewhere between a 3, 4, 5, and 6. And then those higher intensities, 7, 8, 9, 10, that would be also an easy way to do that. But I would encourage a lot of people to get a heart rate monitor, even if you're not going to use it, because it can provide some pretty valuable insights. One thing about perceived exertion is that it does kind of require a bit of practice to kind of know what your effort is. You know, if you're new to training, you might start an easier workout and think that you're at a 7, but the more you kind of learn about your own body, you realize, oh, well, maybe that's not a 7, maybe this is more like a 4. So it takes a little bit of time and practice and experience to kind of learn what certain RPEs are, but after you do that, it can be pretty useful.
And a lot of people that exercise, certainly a lot of the people I speak to in the clinic, do a lot of walking. I think that's the preferred exercise for a lot of people, usually at a moderate intensity. And as you said, that's really excellent base training. Not a lot of people do a high intensity or vigorous exercise. Certainly as people get older, the numbers seem to drop off. And you, of course, mentioned the importance of that for improving cardiorespiratory fitness. At a physiologic level, why is it so important to hit those higher intensities?
Several reasons. One of them is just going to be that there seems to be a certain intensity where if we want to maintain our cardiac function, so our heart's pumping capacity, high-intensity training, so training at those higher heart rates and forcing the heart to work a little bit harder, seems to be very important, especially as people get older and the heart kind of becomes a little stiffer and less responsive to training. If we want to sort of prevent or sometimes even reverse, as some studies can kind of show, the aging of the heart, engaging in some type of high-intensity training seems to be important. And then for metabolic health too, again, like I think just stressing your mitochondria's ability to produce energy at a high rate is very important. You know, we have an epidemic of metabolic kind of dysfunction, not only in, you know, the United States, but kind of throughout the world. And low intensity training and any type of physical activity is obviously going to be help with that for glucose regulation and things like that. But high intensity training, and it really does seem to have unique effects on our ability to utilize energy, our kind of ability to switch between fuel sources during exercise, this thing called metabolic flexibility. And again, overall for the heart function as well. One other thing that I maybe don't talk about as much, and we don't talk about as much if we're just focusing on VO2 max, but that's the brain health benefits, which really seem to hinge on performing high intensity activity. Low intensity activity is great for the body, but when it comes to improving brain health and preventing dementia, cognitive decline, high intensity exercise, it seems to be so beneficial. And I think that alone kind of would be enough for people to at least get your heart rate high once per week, just for those brain health benefits, not only to improve your cognitive function just in day to day, but staving off cognitive decline, which again, seem to be kind of one of the major diseases like afflicting a lot of people as they age.
Some of that, or a good bit of that, is driven by lactate. Can you explain that a little bit more?
So lactate, it's kind of interesting because even myself, like as an undergrad in exercise science, when you're reading kind of the textbooks, you read about lactate, sometimes erroneously referred to as lactic acid. That is like this toxic metabolic byproduct. And, you know, when we talked earlier off camera about how you were an 800 meter runner, you know, when you're on that final lap of the 800 meter, you feel the burning in your legs and it's attributed to lactic acid. Oh, the burning of lactic acid. And we have to flush it out after we work out to help with recovery. All of that kind of seems to be wrong, at least in the way that lactic acid is not a toxic metabolic byproduct. It's actually a fuel that our body can use. And not only can it use that, but in fact, it seems to prefer lactate over some other fuel sources, at least when it's available. At least the brain and the heart especially seem to love to use lactate as a fuel. So it is produced when we exercise, and it's produced at a little bit higher rate when we're exercising at a high intensity because it's a byproduct of the breakdown of glucose. So when we use glucose from carbohydrates as a fuel source, we produce lactate. Now our body can recycle that lactate through something called the lactate shuttle, and it can take that lactate to our muscles, to our brain, to our heart, where it can be used to produce energy. So it's not causing muscle fatigue. That's due to several factors, but the accumulation of kind of acidic hydrogen ions actually seem to more explain kind of the fatigue. But we produce lactate during exercise. Why it rises during high intensity exercise is simply because when we're producing a bit more of it, our lactate production outstrips our ability to clear it. So we can't clear it at a fast enough rate, and thus it starts to accumulate. And that's why for so long it was attributed to fatigue, because you put somebody on a treadmill, you have them run as hard as they can for 30 minutes, their lactate levels rise and they get more tired. Well, okay, well, lactate's the cause of that fatigue. Well, no, it's really just associated. Lactate is associated with exercise intensity, and it's not a cause of muscle fatigue. As you mentioned, that lactate in the brain health benefits, our brain can use lactate as a fuel, but lactate in the brain also seems to induce the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, which is good for something called neurogenesis, increasing the efficiency and maybe the number of neurons. You know, I'm not a neurobiologist, but I think there's been some debate over whether we actually like grow new neurons or whether there's like some plasticity going on. So BDNF is great for the brain. That's associated with better brain health. And so lactate appears to be a crucial part of that. It also has several other signaling effects in the body as well. It improves our insulin sensitivity and our glucose regulation. So it's an important part of exercise, and it's one of the key molecules that signals to the body to adapt to the exercise that we're doing. So again, if we go back to why then high intensity exercise is going to be so important. That's because it leads to more lactate production. And in contrast to what most people would say, we don't want lactate, you actually do, because that's what's leading to a lot of these brain benefits and a lot of these metabolic benefits of exercise.
There's also a lot of interest on how our lifestyle impacts our gene expression through epigenetics, and lactate plays a role in that process as well. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it does. And it's kind of not maybe my area of expertise, but given that we know that it's that this signaling molecule and has all of these signaling effects, it would certainly make sense that it would have these epigenetic effects. There was something recently that I think I read and wrote about where lactate was causing an epigenetic change in the brain. It caused lactylation, I think was the correct term, of certain genes in the brain. So these transcriptional modifications, these epigenetic modifications, and that was kind of responsible for some of the beneficial effects. And I have no doubt that these would be related to perhaps not only the beneficial effects in our own body, but then, you know, there's the whole idea of maybe passing down the benefits of exercise, and maybe that could happen through some epigenetic mechanism. But yeah, I will claim to not have maybe much expertise there, but there's certainly some evidence that that's occurring.
Right, which, you know, again, is so profound that the higher intensities we can lactylate, because so much of epigenetic changes are through methylation, but just such a direct causal link between, you know, how we are optimizing our gene expression is just so interesting. One thing you mentioned a little earlier that may seem a little counterintuitive, I want to go back to, as people get older, you mentioned, of course, the heart muscle maybe is just getting a little weaker, and the way to kind of improve and help it strengthen is to push into the higher intensities. And for some people, that may seem counterintuitive. As the heart is getting older, can it handle the higher intensities? You know, do we need to, quote, you know, act our age, if you will, because everything you're saying about the importance of keep essentially exercising your brain at this high intensity and your heart, how does the body handle that higher intensity as a person's getting older?
It seems to handle it just fine. I mean, I truly don't think that there is any evidence out there to indicate that people in their 60s, 70s, 80s can't for some reason engage in high intensity training. I mean, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of studies showing that people can perform 85 to 95% of their maximal heart rate. The exercise modality might change. You know, a lot of people who are 60, 70, or 80 are going to be running on a treadmill, but they can certainly get on a stationary bike or one of those air-dyne bikes where you're using your arms and your legs. People of any age can engage in those types of exercise. And because it's all relative, my 95% of my maximal heart rate is the same relative intensity as someone who is 80 who has a maximal heart rate of 130 instead of, say, 180. And so they can tolerate it just fine. There's, unless you have underlying risk factors or a contraindication to exercise, there's no reason why you need to, like you said, quote unquote, act your age. And in fact, I think it becomes more necessary as you get older to kind of push those higher intensities as the body, not only, you know, with aerobic training, but also with strength training, as the body becomes less responsive to exercise. We need to engage in higher intensity exercise to force the body to respond and kind of prevent some of these processes of aging from occurring. So yeah, there's no reason. I mean, I've read even in the past few years, I think as we understand more about aging, strength training studies, aerobic exercise training studies in octogenarians, people who are 80 plus years old, nonagenarians, people who are 90 plus years old, putting them through these strenuous exercise training programs and showing that they can build muscle, build strength, reverse the aging of their heart. So it's pretty incredible, and certainly no reason why older individuals, and you know, older is always relative, like what do we mean by that? But they can certainly engage in high intensity exercise with no worries.
And there's also a lot of interest around women going through menopause and the drop in estrogen, that loss of anabolic signaling that comes from estrogen, and kind of a recommendation that's pretty widespread of women to focus on resistance training for muscle building and kind of shying away from the aerobic endurance type exercises. Do you have any thoughts or recommendations on just postmenopausal aging and the hormonal effects?
Yeah, for sure. It is interesting because I've seen a lot of videos circulating on like social media lately where they're recommending against postmenopausal women doing cardio because it will, you know, mess with their hormones and the cortisol increases and things like that. I'm not, you know, a women's health expert, and I certainly think that prioritizing, a lot of women do not prioritize strength training, and they probably should, especially with the changes in bone health that occur with menopause, the changes in muscle mass that can occur with menopause. You know, this happens in men too, but maybe women to a larger extent due to that loss of estrogen, like you said. So I think, yes, prioritizing strength training is probably good. But then given everything we just talked about the benefits of high intensity training and low intensity aerobic exercise for just overall metabolic fitness and preventing heart aging, I certainly don't think that it's something that postmenopausal women should skip out on. Interestingly, so when I was in graduate school, the lab that I was a part of, we investigated endothelial function and vascular health in response to exercise. And so I was doing a lot of reading, and a lot of it was on this research area on postmenopausal women and how they respond to aerobic exercise. And similarly to kind of the loss of estrogen maybe affecting strength training adaptations, it also seemed to affect their ability to adapt in terms of improving their blood vessel health in response to exercise. So losing estrogen actually prevented them from enhancing their endothelial function after performing aerobic exercise training, which is in contrast to what normally happens in premenopausal women or in men, where they engage in endurance training and they improve their endothelial function. Then when you gave them estrogen, they improved. So this loss of estrogen seemed to kind of block some of these beneficial adaptations from occurring. Again, some of that has kind of been debated, and I think that, you know, there are certainly benefits regardless of what some of those studies might show. But again, I think what that points to is they need to even more prioritize perhaps engaging in cardiovascular exercise due to the benefits on endothelial function and cardiovascular health, which are very, very, very strong predictors of cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. So it's certainly not something to neglect, but, you know, you obviously don't want to neglect strength training either. So I think you shouldn't certainly, you know, put all your time into just doing low intensity cardio, because that could have some ramifications, but definitely don't neglect aerobic exercise.
Mm-hmm. With the time we have left, Brady, I want to ask you about a recent study that I think you've seen in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology that looked at intensity as well as volume of exercise and looking at the role of physical activity and longevity and all-cause mortality. Can you talk a little bit about that study?
Yeah. So what they attempted to do, again, is kind of answer like this existential question, you know, what's more important, exercise volume or exercise intensity? And so this was an observational study, so that comes with all the natural limitations maybe of an observational study, but essentially what they did was gather information using accelerometers, so activity trackers, on these participants. They used it to classify their activity into three different groups or tertiles, I guess. So they had physical activity volume, so people with the lowest levels, people in the middle, people with the highest levels of physical activity volume. So that's just, what's your physical activity? How much are you doing per week? Then they did the same thing for intensity. So they said people accumulating the lowest amounts of higher intensity activity, the middle amounts of higher intensity activity, and the highest amounts of activity. And then they compared all those groups. So how does volume relate to reductions in all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality? And then did the same thing with intensity. Not surprisingly, both of them. So doing more volume every week reduced was associated with a lower risk for all-cause mortality. Same thing with intensity. However, the effect of intensity seemed to be stronger. So I think it was about double the lower risk. So say, I think, for instance, between like 10 and 20% reductions in all-cause mortality for people doing the most volume, and then comparison to like a 30 to 40% reduction for people engaging in the most intensity. So the conclusion from there was intensity is more important for reducing all-cause mortality. And then when it came to cardiovascular mortality, only intensity was associated with it. So comparing volume, the highest to the lowest, there was no reduced risk in the people doing the higher amounts of volume. But people doing more intensity, they had a much lower risk than people engaging in less exercise intensity. So the conclusion of that was, yes, again, don't not focus on volume because it is important and it's associated with lower risk. But when it comes to maybe what to prioritize, intensity seems to matter a bit more for mortality than does exercise volume. That's just one study of many. There have been several studies kind of like this published. Depending on what you look at, you'll see, yes, volume is important. Yes, intensity is important. Both are important. But this one was interesting in that it kind of isolated intensity as as being a little bit more important. And so it will, I'm certainly interested in that. And I think it points to, there's a reason to explain it. You know, we can think about all the benefits of high intensity exercise, like we just talked about regarding like cardiovascular mortality. It kind of makes sense that, you know, if it is true that high intensity exercise leads to a little bit better improvements in VO2 max, cardiac function, and things like that, it makes sense that it might be a little bit more important for reducing your cardiovascular mortality risk.
Yeah, it brings us full circle back to the importance of cardiorespiratory fitness, and that maybe as we are getting older, our hearts need that extra intensity, that stress on the heart to adapt and keep us living longer and healthier.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it always comes back to balancing it and the inevitable conclusion of like, yes, you should do both. But certainly, I think, you know, that's not like a fun conclusion to make, because people always kind of want to say like, what should I really focus on? I mean, obviously, so, you know, do strength training every week, do some endurance training every week, elevate your heart rate with high intensity training at least once per week. But I do think it is fun to say that, okay, well, we all kind of, eventually we have to choose what to prioritize, because none of us have unlimited time. None of us work out for a living. Sometimes I wish I did. I think that would be kind of fun, but we have to prioritize something. And so if you are time limited, and if you really are trying to focus on getting your VO2 max as high as possible, then I think the intensity lever is something for people to kind of get interested in. So find what you enjoy and do that.
Yeah, which I think is a really important takeaway from our conversation, that, you know, just incorporating some of the higher intensity, not to fear it, not to shy away from it, regardless of where a person is, and just gradually work in, and what's intense to you is going to be different than what's intense to me, but pushing just so we adapt and kind of build that up. So Brady, thank you so much. This is such great information. I do want to mention that your newsletter, for all of the people listening, is phenomenal. I love your newsletter. I think it has so much great information about all of the latest studies that are coming out. Really does a beautiful job explaining the physiology about us performing better and being healthier. So thank you for doing that kind of work. Is always a labor of love. So pouring all that you put into it.
Certainly is.
How can people learn more about you, about the newsletter?
Yeah. So you mentioned the newsletter that is on Substack. It's kind of the platform that's on Physiologically Speaking. And if you just go to physiologicallyspeaking.com, that domain name, you can kind of find the Substack. And then I'm very active on X. People can find me there. My username is B_Holmer, H-O-L-M-E-R. So just B and then my underscore, my last name. Those are the two primary places. You know, I have other accounts, but I don't post too much on them. So if they want to reach out or find out everything that I'm working on, you can do it in either of those places.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Sharon. I appreciate the kind words about my Substack, and I enjoyed our conversation a lot.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.